the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for downloading it, and I invite you to share it with a friend. And I want to thank friends, people I've never met, who support this program, like Deborah Gordon, Mark Brodsky in Illinois, Russ Archibald in Hawaii, and new subscriber Christopher Welsh. They support us with voluntary subscriptions, and if you're so inclined, you can do it too. The details are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com, and the voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. Thanks again. You're about to hear the latest installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with the amazing Sibel Edmonds. And Sibel is thinking about starting a fan club for today's guest, Pepe Escobar. We both share great respect for this globe-trotting reporter who is not bound by the conventions and the politics of the American media. And so he offers you views that you won't hear in the corporate media in this country and alternatives to American motives, particularly when it comes to the uneven response to the Arab Spring. So sit back and enjoy a great conversation now with Pepe Escobar.
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And our returning guest today is globetrotting international reporter Pepe Escobar from Asia Times. If you haven't already, you must visit their website. It's simple, atimes.com. And they provide really exceptional coverage, particularly if you're looking for news and views that somehow don't make it into the corporate media here in the United States. Pepe, it's a delight to talk with you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Sibel. It's great to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back, Pepe.
And Pepe, you and I spoke just a few weeks ago for the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I want to recommend that to people. You rocked the Casbah in more ways than one, and we will touch on some of the issues that we discussed there as well. But you have been providing very important coverage of the so-called Arab Spring, and the information and the viewpoints that you deliver are generally filtered out of the American media. And I'd like to start with just the overview of U.S. policy toward these revolutions and protests in the streets of multiple countries in the Middle East. We know that WikiLeaks was at least partly responsible for sparking the uprising in Tunisia. And it has been fascinating to watch the varied reactions of the U.S. government. And for the moment, I'd like to focus on Libya and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Because what we see there is, in each case, a very different response from the United States. And we are still attempting to protect the civilians of Libya with the... it's this bizarre notion where the NATO mission doesn't include killing Gaddafi, but the leaders of the NATO countries all say that they want Gaddafi dead. And so as we look at this and ask, well, what is the United States' interest that propelled our involvement in Libya, and why is it not in the United States' interest to support the aspirations of the people of Bahrain and the people of Syria, who are being deliberately squelched by their government in a most violent way?
Well, Peter, I wish I had 5 days to answer your question. And obviously, we cannot answer this question in a Hollywood minute. But the basic fact of, I've been following this since late January, basically. So what do we have at the moment? For me, the most startling fact, and tragic, I would add, is that the counter-revolution after the initial Arab Spring seems to be winning, at least for the moment. I think the decisive moment would be the Egyptian parliamentary and presidential elections, but we're not there yet, 2 months. In the beginning, these movements in Tunisia and especially in Egypt, they have been brewing for a long time. They involve not only the Facebook, YouTube, Google generation, as was widely advertised, especially in the American media, but also the working class. Normal workers in gas fields or textile factories in Egypt, for instance. And when, in the beginning, after the Wael Ghanim people, let's put it this way, got out in the streets and managed to more or less occupy Tahrir Square, the working class, a few days later, they were together. And this became what was in the beginning. It was an underground popular movement that became overground. And it's because we had this union, very close union between students, intellectuals, the wild all over the world generation, with the people who suffered a $1 to dollar a day, $3 a day maximum in Egypt, not only in urban areas but in the countryside. That's why this revolution was successful, because they were at the point of paralyzing the Egyptian economy when the Mubarak system had to give way. In fact, Mubarak himself, the system is still there. We cannot forget that. Then the revolution, the Arab Spring, start moving. And it happened in Bahrain, in the Gulf, even before Libya. In Libya, there was a legitimate protest movement, the February 17 movement. I was in contact with this guy since the beginning. This was basically the Google, YouTube, Facebook generation. Younger guys, unemployed, they knew what's happening in the Arab world and also in the West as well. They had legitimate grievances against what, it is a dictatorship in Libya, of course, but a lot of people also benefited from it. Not only Libyans, but also people from sub-Saharan Africa. Anyway, they had their legitimate grievances. But then, when their popular protest exploded in Benghazi, especially, then moved to the rest of Cyrenaica, the usurpers came in. And in fact, these legitimate grievances were usurped by a bunch of Gaddafi defectors from the inner circle of the Gaddafi regime. And then, of course, the famous exiles, Ahmed Shalabi style. And then they constituted this Libyan Transitional Council, which in a presentation in London changed its name in a pure Washington PR operation to INC, Interim National Council. So, the parallels with the INC at the time of the good after the war in Iraq, they were so startling, for most journalists who had followed what happened in 2002, 2003. So, and then the exiles start coming back, including General Khalifa Hifter, who lived in Vienna, Virginia for 20 years, and everybody knew was a CIA asset. And then he arrived back in Cyrenaica, proclaiming himself the leader, the military commander of the Transitional Council. And at the same time, a lot of independent journalists, I may say, were investigating why this thing exploded in Libya, because in Libya it's not only a legitimate youth revolution like in Tunisia or in Egypt, allied with the working class. It's a sectarian thing. It's a regional thing, and it's only part of the country. It's only the eastern part, which they have always had tribal problems. Historically, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, east and western Libya. So then we start knowing what happened in 2010 when a key Gaddafi ally, his chief of protocol, defected to Paris in October 2010. He was approached by French intelligence, and together they devised a sort of military coup. So in the end, the original revolution, as was devised by these Gaddafi defectors and Western powers, the British also got into it later on, was basically a military coup to get rid of Gaddafi using legitimate grievances from eastern Libya, Cyrenaica. And then the plot thickened when we learned that the Americans got on board later on, and that would be from January to February, because they saw an opening for AFRICOM, the African command, which is based in Stuttgart, Germany, because nobody from the African Union wanted them to be in Africa. So this was the perfect opening for an AFRICOM operation, the first Africa war for AFRICOM, in fact, an opening for NATO, because NATO could have a base in Libya, especially preferably in eastern Libya. That's part of the NATO agenda of having the Mediterranean as a NATO lake. Used to be the Mare Nostrum of the Romans. Now it would be the Mare Nostrum for the American Europeans. Europeans controlled by the Americas. That's what NATO is, basically. And at the same time, they saw that, why do we need to get rid of Gaddafi? First of all, because he's not one of our bastards. He's an independent dictator. He's doing deals with China. That's horrible. So China, like in the U.S., this was reported like in page 9B. They had 35,000 workers working basically in the oil industry in Libya. They were evacuated in a matter of less than 3 days with the extreme efficiency Chinese style and in silence as well. They flew cargo planes from Xinjiang in western China to evacuate these people. It was an amazing operation. And then, of course, the whole thing that we only learned after the fact. Why the West wanted to intervene in Libya, why the West did not intervene in Tunisia and in Egypt, why the West would never even dream of intervening in Bahrain. Because then the House of Saud showed its real colors. There was something that, among Asia Times, among other people, not as explicit as Asia Times, we reported that there was a backroom deal between basically the U.S. Department of State and the House of Saud, where the State Department gave a free hand from the House of Saud to deal with anything that happened in Bahrain, like you are the top dog in Bahrain, but we need a vote from you via the Arab League so we can have our resolution to basically declare war against Libya passed United Nations. And this is exactly what happened. Robert Gates was in with King Hamad in Bahrain on a Saturday, and on Sunday night, the troops from the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, led by Saudi Arabia with some troops from the Emirates, they invaded across the causeway, went to Manama, 20 minutes, and they arrived in Manama, and they started smashing the Bahrain pro-democracy protests, which are not exclusively Shiite. We have to say this all the time. They are majority Shiite, but a lot of Sunnis that were protesting against the small Sunni minority that controls everything in Bahrain, allied with the Al Khalifa dynasty, and obviously the other ones who profit from it are expats who work in the financial industry in Bahrain. And the most of the population, the bulk of the population, at least 70%, which are mostly Shias, they are treated like third-class citizens in their own country. Just like the immigrants who go to work in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, but at least they are not nationals, they are foreigners. They are also treated like third-class citizens. So then we learn all this, and then it was possible to put in place, more or less, the roadmap of how the Arab Spring evolved, or in fact was hijacked later on by Western interests, not only America, but the Europeans as well. The French had enormous interests in Libya. Like one of the reasons why the French, why especially the Sarkozy government, took the initiative into drafting the resolution at the UN, and then they were the first to attack the Gaddafi forces with their Mirage and Rafale, so a few hours after the resolution, because Gaddafi went back on deals he had theoretically made with Sarkozy for buying, in fact, Rafales for the Libyan Air Force and maybe letting the French build nuclear power stations in Libya. So Gaddafi was having second thoughts about it. This was one of the main reasons that the French needed to change all this. And Total didn't have, Total from France, the giant energy company, didn't have the presence that they wanted to have in Libya. In fact, Eni from Italy got the bulk of the oil contracts with Libya. Most of Libyan oil exports went to Italy and not to France. And France was not very happy with it. And that was the subplot of a very, very hardcore catfight between the Sarkozy and the Berlusconi government. That was the background story of all this. Okay, so trying to sum it all up in another 2 or 3 minutes. The House of Saud got what it wanted in Bahrain, which was to smash the peaceful protest that was a peaceful revolution, which was not, you know, they didn't even want in the beginning the downfall of the Al Khalifas. They wanted more political participation, a real parliament, the end of corruption, all these things. And then when they start to be repressed, they immediately switched to bring down the Al Khalifas. So, and obviously, Saudi Arabia managed to convince the Americans because they invoked the same thing they have been invoking for decades. This is an Iranian plot. They want a base here, side by side with our eastern provinces, which are majority Shiite, side by side with their oil-producing areas. We simply cannot allow that. And obviously, the Americans said, yes, okay, go ahead, do what you want. But we need the Arab vote, the Arab League vote. They got the vote, but it was a fake vote. 22 members of the Arab League, only 9 were present at the time. 6 of them were Gulf GCC countries. They had to cajole Jordan, which was very, very easy. Jordan, in fact, is going to become a member of the GCC sooner than later. So they delivered the vote. 3 days later, we got the UN Resolution 1973. And this, 2 days after Gaddafi had given an interview to German television, which was not reported in the U.S., by the way, when he said, look, if I am attacked, I'm going to transfer all energy contracts to Russian, Chinese, and Indian companies. After he said that was signing his death sentence as far as international big oil, international finance is concerned. So then the revolution started turning into a counter-revolution, organized by Saudi Arabia inside the Arab League in terms of repression of Bahrain, in terms of getting rid of Gaddafi as well, because there was this enormous feud that had been going on for years, since at least 2002, between King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and Muammar Gaddafi, when Gaddafi had a famous Arab League meeting, told the King Abdullah in his face, which in the Arab world is absolutely unthinkable, you are a traitor, you're a traitor of the Arab nation, you're sold out for the Americans for the invasion of Iraq. And obviously since then, the bad blood between them has been absolutely, beyond any, beyond our imagination. So then the counter-revolution spread out, and now we have an Anglo-French-American consortium launching an illegal war against a sovereign government legitimized by the UN and with NATO as the weaponized arm of this war, not only later, started with AFRICOM as well. We have AFRICOM launching its first African war as well. We have AFRICOM, NATO, the Brits and the French trying to get Libya as their base in the Mediterranean and in Northern Africa to control basically that area. And that, in fact, would, in terms of intimidating democratic movements in Egypt and Tunisia, both bordering Libya, would be very, very strong. And the initial impetus of the revolution soon turned into, you know, the counter-revolution is, in fact, winning. And what's going to happen to the popular movement started in Tunisia and Egypt? So this, I hope the next step in this roadmap will be the streets reclaim their power and the democratic forces all over these countries, including the ones that are being heavily suppressed, like Bahrain, for instance, or Eastern Saudi Arabia, they regain the initiative. But for the moment, the panorama is bleak. And in the middle of this bleak panorama, intervened the raid that killed or did not kill Osama bin Laden, where the headlines then turned totally. Everyone simply forgot about the Arab Spring to talk about something that in the minds of most Arabs, especially the young generation, is already gone, because al-Qaeda had already lost the war for the Arab hearts and minds. And they were destroyed in the streets and by what people really want. They want democracy. They don't want a caliphate. And they don't want what Osama al-Zawahiri or al-Aklawi or Zarqawi or any one of these bogeymen. That seems to be an assembly line of bogeymen. They don't want what these people were preaching. So
let's talk about Egypt's political status. I mean,
I'm sorry?
The real status, political status right now for Egypt. I mean, right now you have military in control.
Yeah.
Okay, and I just was reading this morning, and they are seeking $4 billion in IMF loans. This is Egypt. And another $2.5 billion from the World Bank, and we know what happens when IMF and World Bank they get involved, and what kind of a future for democracy we can expect in a country once they start falling into the trap of this IMF and World Bank.
You're absolutely right, Sybil, and in fact, this is Egypt's main problem at the moment. They are not able to feed themselves. They are not able to pay their bills. So what the Mubarak legacy is a state that is in absolute shambles. So they have to go to the IMF and World Bank. They are, you know, they are already mortgaging their immediate future. Otherwise, they cannot even, you know, end this current fiscal year in terms of paying their bills and feeding their population. This is what's terrible, and because this is what, at the moment, this the Tantawi-led military council in Egypt is more or less not managing the situation. So this, in fact, is what the, let's hope, really democratic sovereign government of Egypt is going to inherit next year. So can you imagine? They're going to start with a huge handicap against them already.
Exactly. And how do you view al-Baradei?
al-Baradei.
Yeah.
In fact, al-Baradei, nobody's talking about al-Baradei these past few weeks in the Egyptian media itself. It's funny because it seems like he's being sidelined by the Egyptians themselves, especially because of his alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. You remember when the Muslim Brotherhood endorsed him?
Right.
In the first few weeks of the Tahrir Square protest.
Right.
And for secular Egyptians, this didn't go down well at all. So I wonder, maybe he's just recalibrating his, I would say, electoral machine and will be back in full force before the September elections. But for the moment, he's completely sidelined. Nobody's talking about him.
See, there was one thing that never made sense. In January, he was arrested. Was reported that he was placed under house arrest, and this was around end of January 2011.
Yes.
And it was basically the coverage went that he was in a place under house arrest, and the next day he was interviewed by Al Jazeera and he came out and he said he was unaware of any such arrest. I mean, what happened there? That mystery never got resolved either.
Exactly. He was under house arrest by the Mubarak regime, but we have to remember that at the time the Mubarak regime was already more or less splitting. So this split among the military, in fact, the Mubarak regime is a military dictatorship in disguise, né? But there were heavy splits inside it, between the Minister of Interior, between Tantawi, which was more hardliner. There were other ones that there were more in a conciliatory mood. So this might explain why the house detention lasted 24 hours.
But then why would he come out and deny it? The next day when he was interviewed by Al Jazeera, he said no, he was not arrested. He was not placed under house arrest.
I wouldn't know how to answer this question, Sybil,
because,
really, frankly.
Yeah. Well, and also you're looking at a system man. You know, this guy was with the United Nations for 20-plus years, you know, starting as a bureaucrat and making his way up. And we know how much control, how much power the United States has over the United Nations. So so you're looking at a man who lasted in this institution, greatly under the United States influence, for over two decades.
True. And in fact, El Baradei would be the ideal candidate for the U.S. because
exactly.
He's more or less a moderate. In economic terms, he's very conservative. He would not antagonize Washington by any means. I doubt if he would antagonize Israel, in fact. So not much would change. The problem, from an American point of view, is that now he's supported by the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Pepe, let me zoom out just a little bit, because I have to suspect mischief on the part of the United States and Israel related to the situation in Egypt, the upcoming parliamentary and then presidential elections. And it's very clear that while Obama speaks to the aspirations of Egyptians and others, the very clear move back in January when Mubarak named Omar Suleiman as his instant vice president and tried to hand off power to him with support from the United States and Israel. That, to me, explains what the real agenda is of those two countries in trying to steer the Egyptian revolution into a friendly outcome. So tell me your thoughts and what you've picked up from non-American media sources about what's going on the ground in Egypt and how it relates to the interests of the U.S. and Israel.
Absolutely. In fact, now, there is, as you know, of course, anybody in the U.S. now knows, there is this retroactive spinning that is being sold in the Western in U.S. mainstream media that the U.S. was in favor of the Tahrir Square protesters from the beginning. Definitely not. You cannot rewrite history like this. They wanted Omar Suleiman because Omar Suleiman, which the protesters themselves, and then I start using their own term, called him Sheikh al-Torture because he was in charge of all the extraordinary renditions, and he was a master torturer with proven cases by Egyptian journalists that he actually tortured some of these people himself or was present when they were tortured. So he was ideal because, why? Netanyahu and the Israeli government, they knew him very well. He was considered a friend of Israel and a valuable ally and a good interlocutor. The CIA knew him very well. He was, in fact, the CIA top interlocutor in Egypt. So the transition, according to Washington, what Hillary Clinton was qualifying as an orderly transition, was Omar Suleiman was not the current military council because they didn't trust these other generals. And Tantawi, I remember reading stuff about Tantawi in New York Times and Washington Post. He was described as unreliable, of course, because he was not, like Suleiman, very intimate with Israelis and with Washington. So this was the original agenda. In the end, remember that Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, I remember him going to Al Jazeera at least twice and saying, Mubarak has to step down, we are supporting the peaceful protest. We are with the people in Tahrir Square. And only at the last minute, the Obama administration said that Mubarak must go. But But they were still sticking to the orderly transition timetable. They wanted Suleiman until the last minute. And in fact, Suleiman was deposed in an internal white coup. That's when Tantawi and his allies took over at the Supreme Military Council. In fact, Mubarak and Suleiman, they got rid of Mubarak and Suleiman at the same time. And now they are running things. And obviously they are making a few concessions, not many. Of course, we don't know how far will they go, especially in terms of foreign policy. But this is an interim government. The Egyptians are saying, okay, let's wait. When we have elections, depending on the outcome, then our whole foreign policy is going to change. And we all know what the Egyptian, absolute Egyptian majority wants. Most people, they want to abrogate the Camp David Accords, in fact. So this, in terms of Washington-Tel Aviv, is the ultimate nightmare. And everything will be done to prevent that. So I would not discount, like many Egyptian bloggers and journalists are saying, look, there's going to be extremely heavy interference in these ballots. We have to be extremely vigilant because someone or some organisms or some foundations or whatever, they might try to steal this election.
And Pepe, the New Yorker recently reported that when Secretary of State Clinton visited Cairo in April, that a group of activists from Tahrir Square refused to meet with her because they thought she had supported Mubarak for too long. But they appeared to have a different perception of President Obama. I find that amusing.
It is amusing. But this shows you how complex is the Egyptian used to be opposition, of course, and now all the progressive strands in all these different Egyptian factions. You know, some are more intellectual than others. Some are totally secular. Some have ties with Islam, but they are not Islamists in a Muslim Brotherhood sense. Some are Western educated. Some want a Turkish model applied to Egypt. Some say, look, maybe some aspects of China as well. We need a strong leader with a strong economic model. So you find everything you can imagine. This example that you mentioned, I think, is very representative. I would say that in the short run, they need to unite themselves and present at least one or two credible candidates with a specific platform. At the moment, we're not hearing anything coherent from all these different strands, and that's the huge problem. It's too disunited at the moment, which is normal considering that the revolution, as we know, it started only 3 months ago.
I think it's time to talk about Osama bin Laden and the ever-changing script.
We could go on for hours on this one.
Please.
Well, let me add that we're talking here in the middle of May on the 17th, and just a few days ago, I heard what I think is the sixth version of the SEALs raid on the alleged mansion. It's not much of a mansion in Abbottabad. So the story continues to shift, but in the United States, there is no critical reporting. And while it's fair to say that media outlets did notice in the first few days that John Brennan's account was not accurate and that the White House had to correct it, they've really closed ranks and stopped criticizing the Obama White House for failing to deliver a coherent narrative.
No, in fact, what baffles me and a lot of international observers, a lot of people in the Middle East, some journalists in Asia as well, I've seen some in Africa as well doing the same thing. How could they not put up a coherent narrative from day one? If they were really observing this compound since August last year, they knew that sooner or later there will be a raid. They had studied all the possible angles of this raid, how to do it, casualties. They could structure a narrative. And once Obama gave the go-ahead for the raid, they could have started structuring the narrative and then filling in the blanks. And then a gag order on everybody from Pentagon, State Department, CIA, whatever, say, okay, this is going to be the official White House version. The problem is the first official White House version was full of holes. That was the Obama speech version. Everybody knew that could not possibly be true. I was reading the other day, for like a few weeks ago, I was reading a retired brigadier, a Pakistani brigadier, saying that in military terms, what the White House was selling was absolutely impossible. And then he mentioned, you know, the Black Hawks, they fly too low and too slow, that it's impossible to arrive in a military, which in fact, Abbottabad is a military base with three cantonments around it. I've been there. It's on the way to Kashmir. I've been there a few times when I wanted to go to Kashmir, Pakistan. It's impossible for foreign helicopters to arrive at this place at midnight that nobody notices. It's completely absurd. And just yesterday, now that you mentioned, I was reading probably the 12th different version of what happened, and it's by one of the compound's neighbors. And what is this guy saying? Which is, this is absolutely revolutionary, and obviously it will never be printed in American mainstream media. He said that only one helicopter arrived. He landed on the ground beside a compound. Like 15 or 20 people got out. Then the helicopter left. And then when the helicopter came back to pick up the what would be the Navy SEALs commandos, it was shot, crashed, and then another helicopter came back to rescue the people who survived the crash. And this guy was on Pakistani Sama TV. I was watching the video yesterday, and it's absolutely outstanding because it's been circulating in Pakistan. A lot of people actually believe it, especially people who live in the area, you know how it works, know how the ISI works, how the military work. The fact that you cannot have a raid like that unless you have clearance from the ISI or the Pakistani military, which the White House and the Pentagon have been saying they didn't have. So it's impossible to believe. In fact, in the end, you don't believe in any of these versions because each is more outlandish than the next.
Tell us, uncensored, your take. Why? Why all these discrepancies? And what's happening here?
Oh, Sybil, this is complicated.
Speculate. You know, I know it's speculation because we don't have all the evidence, obviously. We know the lies we are being given, and we have pretty good theories on why, but we don't have any what happened.
Exactly. We don't have enough elements because we only have one side of the story. We are, in fact, the one side of the story, it's at least two sides of the story because the White House narrative is not exactly like the Pentagon narrative. And I remember from the beginning, I was looking at tweeters, and there were people from the Pentagon tweeting a completely different version from the what would be later the official version from the White House, even before the White House went online. So from the beginning, there were huge discrepancies. The Pakistanis are not saying much. They have their reasons. I think they know much more than they are letting us know. But for some reason, they are keeping it, maybe to disclose it later on, considering that the relations between Washington and Islamabad at the moment are absolutely terrifyingly bad. The local Pakistani versions make much more sense. And all of them, they tell us more or less that what happened over there was very murky, that probably there were American casualties, that this helicopter crashed right at the beginning because it was under fire by people at the compound. On the other hand, we have people saying, look, the compound, the main door of the compound was open. And then we have other people saying, look, if Obama, if Osama was here, we would have seen him living here for five years, totally inside a room for 5 years or inside his own compound. It's absolutely impossible. And if you've been to Pakistan, and if you've been to tribal areas, if you've been to how these compounds work, it's true. People talk about the next cow on the block or if people bought a Pepsi instead of a bowl of mineral water. They know everything. It's impossible for anybody, especially in a place like this, and especially foreigners. Don't forget that Osama and the bodyguards, they were Arabs and Yemenis. Everybody knows if there is a foreigner in a small village, especially near a Pakistani military base. So, okay, if Osama was there, the ISI knew he was there. If he was not there, the ISI also knew why he was not there and where he was. Because my Pakistani sources always tell me the ISI has always monitored Obama for 25 years. They always knew where he was. They didn't want to disclose it because there was a code from the top, including the middle rank officers. If anybody said anything, hell to pay. So somebody linked to the ISI, if not an ISI middle rank official as well, probably bagged the $25 million, denouncing it to the Americans. But if he did that, he had top clearance to do that.
So, but hold on a second. This is assuming that Osama has been alive all this time, and in
exactly,
fact,
exactly. You're right, Sybil. Assuming that Osama had been alive all the time. So we have to backtrack then to 2002. I remember by the end of 2002, everyone, Musharraf, Karzai, Saudi intelligence, even Israeli intelligence, the guy from the FBI who was in charge of counterterrorism, everybody was saying he's probably dead. And then the Saudis, by 2006, they gave a definite date of Obama, Osama bin Laden deceased. I think it was August 23rd, 2006, something like this. So all over the world, there was total radio silence about Osama. He was presumed dead. So if he was really, for the past 5 years, living in Abbottabad, the Pakistani military and the ISI had to know it. And then the whole official U.S. narrative crumbles. So the ISI is not saying anything. The Pakistani military are not saying anything either. They have their motives. Nobody knows what they're going to do with this information. But I assume that sooner or later, the official story will be disclosed. This may take years, in fact.
Well, you say, this is the sentence from your article, almost a decade after 9/11, and with the Bush dead or alive promise finally fulfilled Terminator style, where does the former hyperpower go next? Where is it going?
Well, I would tell you, Sybil, after 3 or 4 days, I start working on a possible hypothesis, which is very possible in my view, that maybe Obama had all the elements with him, raid or no raid, Osama dead or Osama to be officially pronounced dead, and he decided in the end, after a lot of cool calculation, that's how he worked. He said, okay, I'm going to finish this story once and for all. Like he was posing like the psychoanalyst in chief. If I have to exterminate the trauma on 9/11, I have to exterminate the so-called perpetrator. Even if he was not indicted, even if he was not guilty as charged, even if he was not charged. Okay, so by eliminating the perpetrator, I can move on to the things that I really need to do, which is trying to find a solution to the Middle East, trying to get a peace process going, reorganize ourselves in Central Asia, see what's going to happen with these Arab Spring revolutions, and see how the U.S. is going to be positioned about all these movements. And there was always this 9/11 Osama bin Laden trauma, you know, interfering in all this. So whatever happened, Obama decided, okay, this is closure, and then we move on. In fact, it was his own words, man, in one of his speeches. Now we move on. So, but I'm not sure the way they did it was the right way because they didn't have a convincing narrative, not even for a lot of Americans.
And Pepe, to me, the shifting versions of the story indicate the elements of PSYOPs, psychological operations, where
right.
They attempted to construct a narrative. And I'm lost in the ozone here because, yes, I've heard the reports, and you and I last spoke about how Benazir Bhutto believed that Osama bin Laden was dead, and that was in 2007.
Exactly.
So there are a lot of markers out there to suggest that he was already dead. That said, if we start to take some of the elements of the White House story at face value, the conflicts arise with the shifting versions. And again, what that mostly suggests to me is an attempt to control the story, and you only need to control a story if you're making it up. If it's real, you simply report, you know, for good or bad, what actually occurred, who did what to whom, at what time. But the various stories that we're hearing suggest a mismanaged attempt to manage the information, and that suggests that, well, this is concocted, at least to some extent.
It's true. You're absolutely right. This point, all the suggestions point to a very elaborate psyops that was not discussed to this, you know, to the intimate connections. Because if you pull apart one of the discrepancies, the whole castle of cards, you know, falls to the ground. And this is what's been happening with the official narrative. And lucky for the Obama administration, there's been the widespread Palestinian protests this weekend. There's been the Dominic Strauss-Kahn case. So nobody's talking about Osama bin Laden anymore. There's the renewed offensive, NATO offensive in Libya. So the Osama bin Laden story lasted for 5 days. And now it disappeared completely. That's very lucky for the Obama administration. But it will be back, because, especially because the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan is at an absolutely disgraceful point for both sides, I would say. And the Chinese and the Russians are watching this very, very carefully, and they're bringing Pakistan closer and closer to their fold. So I'll give you an instance of that. Next month, there's going to be the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Astana in Kazakhstan. So what I heard is that the Russians and the Chinese want to bring Pakistan as a member of the SCO and not as an observer anymore. So this would be, you know, in terms of geopolitics in Eurasia as a whole, would be a thunderbolt, really something, an earthquake, a political earthquake. And if that happens, people in Washington are going to be puzzled, and they will not have a counterpunch against that, because this means that in terms of security of Central Asia and South Asia, that area where Afghanistan intersects with Pakistan, the Russians and the Chinese will have the eyes and ears of Islamabad and not Washington anymore. So can you imagine?
Okay, then that's incredible, and I think that gives credence to another hypothesis, and the hypothesis being this was sloppy and had all these discrepancies because the whole script was a rushed job. And why was the rushed job? It had to do with timing, and meaning we had to, or the administration, the government, was preempting something that is about to come or is coming. And if that were the case, this is, you know, the timing of, okay, maybe they'd known bin Laden if he was alive, you know, been living in this location. They did this, and they did it in a rushed manner, because of something that we're going to see very soon, maybe in the next 1 or 2 months, then it will click, because the why answer hasn't been out there. We have been putting a lot of theories and hypotheses out there and a speculation, but the why would be the timing. Why now? Why did they do it now?
Fabulous, Sybil. This is the $1 trillion question. You're absolutely right.
In fact, nobody has come up with
a good argument defending the timing. Nobody. In fact, okay, we could also speculate. Why now? Because the U.S. knew that the relationship with Pakistan was going downhill. They had to do something about it. Because they knew that the geopolitical tectonic plates in Eurasia are moving, and the Russians and the Chinese are being more and more assertive in the region. Because they knew that the NATO quagmire in Afghanistan is going nowhere, they need to do something about it. Perhaps because Obama wanted to have a withdrawal from Afghanistan, although he's still fighting the Pentagon about it, because the Pentagon wants to stay in Afghanistan because it's part of the full-spectrum dominance doctrine, which implies base, military bases in Afghanistan to be close to Russia, to be at least monitoring Russia and China, and because the U.S. simply cannot give up on that part of Eurasia. So all these ifs, they enter.
And
why
Pepe,
this precise
Pepe,
moment? Nobody Pepe, really knows.
And let me interject domestic considerations. The president had recently announced his reelection campaign. He just 4 days before this finally caved in and gave out his long-form birth certificate, having been under assault from Donald Trump.
Right.
And this the shift in the polls is pretty remarkable, because only a week after the announcement on May 1st, we saw that not only did the president's popularity improve, but on the critical question of domestic support for our presence in Afghanistan, the opposition dropped by 17 points.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And this is a situation where the president knows he has a vulnerability on Afghanistan related to his reelection prospects. He has shuffled his cabinet with the very same people, including now the extension of the term for Sabell's favorite public servant, FBI Director Robert Mueller. And so he really is gearing up for domestic consumption of these foreign policy issues, and I think that there is a major focus on his reelection effort.
Now, you're right, Peter. And in fact, we can consider that internal considerations were more powerful than the geopolitical picture in Eurasia. It makes total sense. But it doesn't make sense when you think that the elections in November 2012. Is it too early? It's not going to hold. With the economy in shambles like it is, because the issue in 2012 is not, everybody knows, it's not going to be Eurasia, geopolitics, Afghanistan, Pakistan, or even Iraq. It's going to be the economy.
Yeah. Well, those are all good points, but this was a pivotal point where he did shake off two potential opponents in Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee just mm-hmm. in the last few days. And I think it's because they're looking at the improvement in Obama's poll numbers, and that the Republicans, other than the economy, don't have much to run on. And if anybody looks seriously at Republican positions, they're advocating a continuation of the very same economic policies that crashed our economy. And
you're totally right, yeah.
While the
economic policies and continuation of the wars as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're advocating the status quo. And the good thing for Obama is that he regained the initiative. But what is he going to do in terms of restarting the economy, which does not depend on him? It depends on the structural way the American economy works nowadays. It depends on American multinational companies, for instance. It doesn't depend on the White House. And what is it going to do to rearrange the chessboard in Eurasia, in Northern Africa, in the Middle East? It doesn't depend on the Americans as well. In fact, the Saudis hold all the cards in the Persian Gulf. The Russians and the Chinese are holding most of the best cards in Central Asia, in Eurasia as a whole. In Northern Africa, this thing in Libya could be a quagmire lasting, if not months, maybe years. So the American president cannot control any of these events. So it's an extremely risky strategy, which does not fit the Obama rational way of thinking, in my view.
Well, I don't know if Obama is capable of thinking rationally. Speaking of all the Arab spring and uprising, we are sitting here in the United States and we don't have any other countries that can come and help us. You know, our whistleblowers are being jailed. And they are being persecuted and prosecuted, and our civil liberties are being butchered further and further. And basically, we don't have much left of our liberties. So I don't know who can come out here and help us. But one question I have is on Pakistan, and how much of what we see currently is just for show only posturing, and for Pakistan too. You know how it is in Middle East and in the Near East. You know, when you have the governments, in order to pacify the public, you know, they are the puppets of, let's say, Western countries. They're puppets of the United States. But they have to do the posturing thing. You know, they are, you know, sovereign and they have autonomy and say a bunch of things just for the pacify their own people. So, because we saw similar things between Pakistan and U.S. during this whole AQ Khan disaster and scandal. Okay, I mean,
yeah.
This was when we were going to cut the military aid, the billions of dollars, and they were about to buy these F-16s, and that whole deal, and we had this congressional posturing and inquiries, we have to cut the aid. And guess what? Nothing happened. A lot of posturing, but considering the importance and the reliance and the commonality between the two and the dependency of Pakistan, the Pakistan military, on U.S., how much of what we are seeing, especially with the U.S. politicians, oh, we have to cut the, how much of it is just pure cosmetic posturing, and how much of it is real? Because you know about this. You are, I think, one of the best reporters, journalists out there when it comes to that region and these, political dynamics there.
Well, in terms of U.S. posturing, look, if you don't behave like one of our bastards, we're going to cut aid and finance your military. This is completely absurd. If the U.S. did that, the next day, Beijing would come to Islamabad and say, what do you want?
Exactly.
Okay, we'll give you anything you want, plus we're going to rebuild your country because your roads are horrible, your schools are horrible, you need electric dams, you need gas, you need oil, you need hydroelectric. You know, they would do exactly what they do with the Africans. Why China is winning in Africa and the Pentagon is so desperate that they need an AFRICOM to launch a war against a sovereign country in Northern Africa? Because the Chinese go to Zambia, for instance, or Nigeria or Angola, and they say, okay, we need your natural resources. We need your uranium, your manganese, your oil and gas. We pay a good market price for this, or we can exchange. What do you need? Do you need schools? Do you need highways? Do you need dams? We built them for a very good price with our excellent engineering firms. We won't interfere in your internal politics. We get out of here, live with your natural resources, sold at a very good price. You make a profit, and that's it, and we remain friends. So this is exactly what China will do with Pakistan. They are already allies, in fact. In fact, one of the reasons that the U.S. has a strategic relationship with Pakistan is because Pakistan has a strategic relationship with China. And if Pakistan becomes an active member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, then we can practically say goodbye to a U.S.-Pakistan strategic relationship. And then Pakistan is already fed up with it. They don't want interference the way the Americans interfere in terms of the drone war in the tribal areas, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say it much because it's part of the deal. Otherwise, they won't get the $1.5 billion in military aid every year. But their sovereignty as a country is being infringed practically on a daily basis. And if we look at the numbers, most of the victims of the drone wars in the Waziristan especially, they are civilians.
Yes.
They are, they are Pashtun marriages. And if you don't pick a fight with a Pashtun, this is something that I learned on the spot by my Pashtun friends.
Uh-huh.
You're going to be an enemy not for life, but for the generations ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So never the U.S. will be able to establish a stronghold in, obviously not in the tribal areas, but even in Pakistan itself. Because don't forget that these Pashtuns who live in the tribal areas or who live across the border, Afghanistan, Pakistan, which for them is not a border because it doesn't exist. For them it's all Pashtunistan. They roam around Pakistan as well. They're very strong in Karachi, as a merchant class in Karachi as well. So the Americans will never be in peace as long as they are established in some way in Pakistan. So forget about it. So what any Republican, especially Republican politician, says in the U.S. is absolutely nonsense.
Pepe, let me turn briefly to two other issues. I would love to talk to you for another hour and a half, but we have to keep in mind.
So much. We didn't even talk about the guy in Rikers Island.
No, we haven't yet. But I wanted to ask you about a recent development. On the 15th of May, the New York Times ran a front page Sunday story about Blackwater founder Eric Prince, who is now a citizen, or at least he's relocated to the Emirates, where he is building a non-Muslim, non-Arab mercenary army. Tell me your thoughts about a mercenary leader like Eric Prince working for the Emirate leaders?
Well, the first thing is, nobody in the Emirates will allow the XE Blackwater XE men to build a non-Muslim mercenary army. These guys have to be necessarily Muslims. The UAE, I would say after Saudi Arabia, the UAE is the most repressive Muslim regime on the planet. So this story is not, I think we don't have all the facts about it. I will investigate this story now that you mentioned. I think I was paying too much attention to DSK and Osama, and I forgot about it. But it doesn't make sense. Not in the UAE. In fact, if this was in Qatar, it would make more sense. Mm-hmm. Because Qatar, compared to the UAE, Qatar is more, I would say, they have a little bit more of a swing that you won't find in the UAE.
But the suggestion from the Times article is that this is essentially modeled on Bahrain, and they're sending a message to the citizens of the Emirates that there will be no spring.
Yes, but this, well, they already sent the message, of course. Compared to Bahrain, repression-wise, things are much easier in the Emirates because it's a hardcore Sunni regime. Most of the locals, they are Sunni. There's a very small, less than 5% Shiite minority. The bulk of the population are expats, in fact, subdivided in different castes. You have the people who are in the tourism, service, and financial sector, especially Anglo-American, South African, Australian, Canadians, a few Europeans. And the bulk of the population, they are the people who build the UAE miracle, especially in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. South Asians, especially Indians and Pakistanis, treated like cattle, third-class citizens, no rights as well. And obviously, there won't be an uprising conducted by these immigrants against the ruling Sunni sheikhdom. No way. In Bahrain, it's different. In Bahrain, the locals are the majority. Most of them are Shiites, and they have been ruled by a Sunni dynasty for 230 years, and they are treated as third-class citizens, just like those South Asian expats in the UAE.
Mm-hmm. The conscripts, yeah. Okay,
exactly.
And finally, I want to take a look at the Israel-Palestine conflict because, as you touched on earlier and in your article published on May 16 called Sunday, Bloody Sunday, you talk about the nonviolent Palestinian uprising that was met with a brutal suppression by Israeli forces. And there are a couple of other factors to throw into the mix here. George Mitchell has resigned as Obama's envoy to the region and to the dispute. Benjamin Netanyahu is bound for Washington to meet with President Obama. And there has been some sort of a rapprochement between Hamas and Fatah. And Israel, which refused to deal with Fatah when they had successfully isolated Hamas, now says they refuse to deal with Fatah because Fatah has, to some extent, reconnected with Hamas. And that suggests to me that Israel isn't interested in talking to the Palestinians under any circumstances. They just look for the nearest pretext to offer the momentary reason why they won't participate. So with that said, give us your thoughts about the current situation in Israel and vis-a-vis Palestine, please.
Yes, look, the official Israeli policy, no matter who's in government, Sharon, Barak, Bibi, you name it, it's still the Isaac Shamir policy. We don't talk to the Palestinians, period. That's it. It's a one no after another. So as you said correctly, any kind of pretext is available. Fatah is corrupt. There is no partner. Hamas is a bunch of terrorists. Hamas and Fatah together is the incompetence allied with the terrorists. You name it. Any pretext. The only possibility would be, from the point of view of Tel Aviv, of course, is sitting down at the table and offering a collection of Bantustans to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians say yes. So there's no 1967 borders, no return of refugees. We have less than 10% of the original Palestinian West Bank, and that gulag, which is Gaza, basically. Anybody who's been to Gaza has been to hell in a Mad Max way, without the cars, of course. So this is the official, BB government policy. The additional problem is that the BB government is not even representative of Israel, because he's completely hijacked, and he's a hostage of the Russian-Ukrainian Immigrants Jewish Party, which is practically a racist party.
And that's Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman.
Exactly. Israel is our home, exactly. Avigdor Lieberman, the only international case of a bouncer who becomes foreign minister. So I'm sure a lot of nightclub bouncers in New York could start, okay, I'm going to be the next Obama. You know? Anyway, so this is what happens. And considering that the BB is a hostage of the extreme right, there's nothing he can do, because he will be brought down by Lieberman and by the ultra-Orthodox. So obviously, this implies the settlement building will continue. So we had this horrible example recently where Obama was publicly humiliated by Netanyahu. The building of the settlements will continue. Maybe I will consider it. He considered it, and he said what? No. And everybody knew from the beginning he would say no. If you were following Israeli politics, everybody knew he would say no. So now we have a different dynamic, because what's going to happen in September during the UN General Assembly will be crucial. What's going to happen? The Palestinians are going to arrive more or less united, Fatah and Hamas. They're going to tell the UN General Assembly, look, we want you to recognize us as an independent state according to the pre-1967 borders. And the whole world will say yes, except who? United States and Israel. So the next step would be what? A UN resolution about it would be vetoed probably by what? U.S. at the UN Security Council,
right.
Obviously, would vote it.
Mm-hmm.
But most countries, if not, I would say maybe a few Europeans would probably vote with the U.S. Probably France and Germany, or maybe Britain would vote with the U.S. And the rest of the world against it. So we have another impasse. So what could develop out of this impasse in the short, middle term would be the beginning of an international boycott against Israel. So if this boycott goes on for 1, 2, 3, 4 years, soon the Israeli electorate will get the message, look, we don't want to live as an eternal pariah in the world community. Something has to give. We have to at least sit down at a table and work out a reasonable agreement. So this is a possibility, and the Palestinians are thinking about this possibility long term. Of course, many people in the Middle East, in Egypt, if you talk to Egyptians nowadays, they say, look, if there is a sovereign government here, the first thing we do, we open the border with Gaza, and we will support the Palestinians to the max. So that's one of Washington's, Tel Aviv's, the supreme nightmares. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen when we have a real sovereign Egyptian government? So for the moment, all eyes on the UN General Assembly in September. That's why Obama is having this speech this week, where he's going to, in the White House words, reset the Middle East process. The problem is, I was reading what he's going to say. That was, in fact, the Chinese got it from an Israeli publication. What? Isn't that fantastic?
Now, wait.
Chinese news agency, they have a guy implanted in the Israeli press.
Well, now, the other explanation is that Obama's going to be delivering a speech that was written in Israel and vetted in China.
Exactly. This is outstanding. So what he's going to say basically is, okay, 1967 borders, but, and then a lot of buts, the Palestinians have to recognize the existence of Israel. They have to renounce terrorism. They won't discuss about settlements that have been built before. There will be no new settlements, but all the settlements that are still there stay. So this means that the West Bank, in a future Palestine, will have more than 100,000 Israeli settlers in the midst, which is completely absurd. So this is what he's going to say, and it's going to be sold by the White House as a reset of the peace process. Obviously, nobody, not even, I'm not saying even Palestine, across the Middle East, nobody's going to buy it. Nobody. So it's already dead on arrival.
Pepe, thank you for a very interesting and informative conversation. I always learn a lot talking with you, I have to say.
Thank you, guys. I wish we could talk about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, which is the best story in the world after the non-Osama story.
Well, we'll save that for the next time, and we'll probably know more about it by then.
And it will be soon.
Pepe Escobar, Asia Times, online at atimes.com. Great to talk with you again.
Thanks, Sybil. Thanks, Peter. It's been an enormous pleasure, as usual.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.